Oh, hey, hi there. I don't normally deal with current events here. I mostly talk about philosophy, sometimes technology, not necessarily wedded to the ebb and flow of the news cycle, shall we say. There was one particular current event that seemed important enough to pique my squelch knob that it was worth commenting on. And in particular, what I want to do is read to you from a book called The Tempting of America. This book was written by a man named Robert Bork. For those of you who don't know your history, Robert Bork was a nominee to the Supreme Court under the Reagan administration, and he was perhaps the first political rejection to the Supreme Court. Prior to Clarence Thomas, Bork was also dragged through the reputation grinder in similar but less dramatic fashion. And in particular, he was vilified for his originalist interpretation of constitutional jurisprudence. You could say he is one of the founders of the originalist position, or at least the best popularizer of the position going forward. This book, The Tempting of America, was his attempt to lay out his jurisprudence and justify it to the country in an attempt to correct the record, to prove he was not a Nazi, right? which. Yes, even then in 1987 or 88, whenever those hearings were, was one of the accusations was that he was a secret Nazi, right? So this is not new, this invective against the right is not new. It's just a continuous recycling of the same complaints. Of them being Nazis and homophobes and white supremacists and blah, 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 blah. This goes all the way back, prior to Reagan, even, but really reached its peak in the Reagan era. In any case, one of the pieces of jurisprudence underpinning the original Roe decision, the decision that was just overturned, was something called the right to privacy, which was imputed into the Constitution by a number of different decisions, starting with the decision that you see on the screen here now, the Griswold v. Connecticut decision. And that's where I will begin my reading. The 1965 decision in Griswold v. Connecticut was insignificant in itself, but momentous for the future of constitutional law. Connecticut had an ancient statute making it criminal to use contraceptives. The state also had a general accessory statute allowing the punishment of any person who aided another in committing any offense. On its face, the statute criminalizing the use of contraceptives made no distinction between married couples and any others. But the statute also had never been enforced against anyone who had used contraceptives, married or not. There was, of course, no prospect that it ever would be enforced. If any Connecticut official had been mad enough to attempt enforcement, the law would at once have been removed from the books and the official from his office. Indeed, some Yale law professors had gotten the statute all the way to the Supreme Court a few years previously, and the court had refused to decide it precisely because there was no showing that the law was ever enforced. The professors had some difficulty arranging a test case, but finally managed to have two doctors who gave birth control information fined $100 apiece as accessories. Such enforcement in the area as there was. Such enforcement in the area as there was consisted of the occasional application of the accessory statute against birth control clinics, usually clinics that advertised. The situation was similar to the enforcement of many anti-gambling laws. They may cover all forms of gambling on their faces, but they were in fact enforced only against commercial gambling. An official who began arresting the priest at the church bingo party or friends having their monthly poker game at home would have made a most unwise career decision and would be quite unlikely to get a conviction. There are a number of statutes like these in various state codes, such as the statutes flatly prohibiting sodomy and other unnatural practices, which apply on their faces to all couples, married or unmarried, heterosexual or homosexual. The statutes are never enforced, but legislators who would be aghast at any enforcement effort nevertheless, often refuse to repeal them. There is a problem with laws like these. They are kept in the code books as precatory statements, affirmations of moral principle. It is quite arguable that this is an improper use of law, most particularly of criminal law, that statutes should not be on the books if no one intends to enforce them. It has been suggested that if anyone tried to enforce a law that had moldered in disuse for many years, the statute should be declared void by reason of disuse, or that the defendant should go free because the law had not provided fair warning. But these were not the issues in Griswold. Indeed, getting off on such grounds was the last thing the defendants and their lawyers actually wanted. Since the lawyers had a difficult time getting the state even to fine two doctors as accessories, it seems obvious that the case was not arranged out of any fear of prosecution, and certainly not the prosecution of married couples. Griswold is more plausibly viewed as an attempt to enlist the court on one side of one issue in a cultural struggle. Though the statute was originally enacted when the old Yankee culture dominated Connecticut politics, it was now quite popular with the Catholic hierarchy and with many lay Catholic whose religious values it paralleled. The case against the law was worked up by members of the Yale Law School faculty and was supported by the Planned Parenthood Federation of America, the Catholic Council on Civil Liberties, and the American Civil Liberties Union. A ruling of unconstitutionality may have been sought as a statement that opposition to contraception is benighted, and therefore a statement about whose cultural values were dominant. Be that as it may, the upshot was a new constitutional doctrine perfectly suited and later used to enlist the court on the side of moral relativism in sexual matters. Justice Douglas's majority opinion dealt with the case as if Connecticut had devoted itself to sexual fascism. Would we allow the police to search the sacred precincts of marital bedrooms for telltale signs of the use of contraceptives? The very idea is repulsive to the notions of privacy surrounding the marriage relationship. That was both true and entirely irrelevant to the case before the court. Courts usually judge statutes by the way in which they are actually enforced, not by imagining horrible events that have never happened, never will happen, and could be stopped by the courts if they ever seemed about to happen. Just as in Skinner, he had treated a proposal to sterilize three-time felons as raising the specter of racial genocide, Douglas raised the stakes to the sky here by treating Connecticut as though it was threatening the institution of marriage. We deal with a right of privacy older than the Bill of Rights, older than our political parties, older than our school system. The thought was incoherent. What the right of privacy's age in comparison with that of our political parties and school system had to do with anything was unclear. And where the right came from, if not from the Bill of Rights, it is impossible to understand. No court had ever invalidated a statute on the basis of the right Douglas described. That makes it all the more perplexing that Douglas, in fact, purported to derive the right of privacy not from some pre-existing right or law of nature, but from the Bill of Rights. It is important to understand Justice Douglas's argument both because the method, though without merit, continually recurs in constitutional adjudication, and because the right of privacy has become a loose canon in the law. Douglas began by pointing out that specific guarantees in the Bill of Rights have penumbras formed by emanations from those guarantees that help give them life and substance. There is nothing exceptional about that thought, other than the language of penumbras and emanations. Courts have often given protection to a constitutional freedom by creating a buffer zone, by prohibiting a government from doing something not in itself forbidden, but likely to lead to an invasion of a right specified in the Constitution. Douglas cited NAACP v. Alabama, in which the Supreme Court held that the state could not force the disclosure of the organization's membership lists, since that would have deterrent effect upon the members' First Amendment rights of political and legal action. That may well have been part of the purpose of the statute. But for this anticipated effect upon guaranteed freedoms, there would be no constitutional objection to the required disclosure of membership. The right not to disclose had no life of its own, independent of the rights specified in the First Amendment. Douglas named the buffer zone, or penumbra, of the First Amendment a protection of privacy, although in NAACP v. Alabama, of course, confidentiality of membership was not required for the sake of individual privacy, but to protect the public activities of politics and litigation. Douglas then asserted that other amendments created zones of privacy. These were the First, Third, soldiers not to be quartered in private homes, Fourth, ban on unreasonable searches and seizures, and Fifth, freedom from self-incrimination. There was no particularly good reason to use the word privacy for the freedoms cited, except for the fact that the opinion was building toward those sacred precincts of marital bedrooms. The phrase areas of freedom would have been more accurate, since the provisions cited protect both private and public behavior. None of the amendments cited, and none of their buffer or penumbral zones, covered the case before the court. The Connecticut statute was not invalid under any provision of the Bill of Rights, no matter how extended. Since the statute in question did not threaten any guaranteed freedom, it did not fall within any emanation. Griswold v. Connecticut was, therefore, not like NAACP v. Alabama. Justice Douglas bypassed that seemingly insuperable difficulty by simply asserting that the various separate zones of privacy created by each separate provision of the Bill of Rights somehow created a general but wholly undefined right of privacy that is independent of and lies outside any right or zone of privacy to be found in the Constitution. Douglas did not explain how it was that the framers created five or six specific rights that could, with considerable stretching, be called privacy. And though the framers chose not to create more, the court could nevertheless invent a general right of privacy that the framers had inexplicably left out. It really does not matter to the decision what the Bill of Rights covers or does not cover. Douglas closed the Griswold decision with a burst of passionate oratory. Marriage is a coming together for better or for worse, hopefully enduring and intimate to the degree of being sacred. It is an association that promotes a way of life, not causes. A harmony in living, not political faiths. A bilateral loyalty, not commercial or social projects. Yet it is an association for as noble a purpose as any involved in our prior decisions. It is almost a matter for regret that Connecticut had not threatened the institution of marriage or even attempted to prevent anyone from using contraceptions, since that left some admirable sentiments, expressed with rhetorical fervor, dangling irrelevantly in midair. But the protection of marriage was not the point of Griswold. The creation of a new device for judicial power to remake the Constitution was the point. The Griswold opinion, of course, began by denying that any such power was being assumed. We are met with a wide range of questions that implicate the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. Overtones of some arguments suggest that Lochner v. New York should be our guide, but we decline that invitation. We do not sit as a super legislature to determine the wisdom, need, and propriety of laws that touch economic problems, business affairs, or social conditions. Griswold As an assumption of judicial power unrelated to the Constitution is, however, indistinguishable from Lochner. And the nature of that power is lack of rationale or structure, ensured that it could not be confined. The court majority said there was now a right of privacy, but did not even intimate an answer to the question, privacy to do what? People often take addictive drugs in private. Some men physically abuse their wives and children in private. Executives conspire to fix prices in private. Mafiosi confer with their button men in private. If these sound bizarre, one professor at a prominent law school has suggested that the right of privacy may create a right to engage in prostitution. Moreover, as we shall see, the court has extended the right of privacy to activities that can in no sense be said to be done in private. The truth is that privacy will turn out to protect those activities that enough justices to form a majority think ought to be protected, and not activities with which they have little sympathy. If one called the zones of the separate rights of the Bill of Rights zones of freedom, which would be more accurate, then should one care to follow Douglass's logic, the zones would add up to a general right of freedom independent of any provision of the Constitution, a general right of freedom. A constitutional right to be free of regulation by law. It's a manifest impossibility. Such a right would posit a state of nature, and its law would be that of the jungle. If the court had created a general right of freedom, we would know at once, therefore, that the new right would necessarily be applied selectively. And if we were given no explanation of the scope of the new right, we would know that the right was nothing more than a warrant judges had created for themselves to do whatever they wished. That, as we shall see in the next chapter, is precisely what happened with the new general undefined and unexplained right of privacy. Justice Black's dissent stated, "I like my privacy as well as the next one, but I am nevertheless compelled to admit that government has a right to invade unless prohibited by some specific constitutional provision." He found none. The court talks about a constitutional right of privacy as though there is some constitutional provision or provisions forbidding any law ever to be passed that might abridge the privacy of individuals, but there is not. He pointed out that there are certain specific constitutional provisions which are designed in part to protect privacy at certain times and places with respect to certain activities. But there was no general right of the sort Douglass had created. Justice Stewart's dissent referred to the statute as an uncommonly silly law, but noted that its asininity was not before the court. He could find no such general right of privacy in the Bill of Rights, in any other part of the Constitution, or in any case ever before decided by this court. He also observed that the court does not say how far the new constitutional right of privacy announced today extends. That was 24 years ago. and the court still has not told us. Now, he wrote that in 1990, so he's talking about... he actually must have written that well before 1990, because the case was 1964. No, I guess that would have been 1988 or so. Anyway, moving on to the next passage, which is sort of the culmination of the right to privacy. So here we go. The years of the Berger and Rehnquist court also saw the right of privacy invented by the Warren Court mature into a judicial power to dictate moral codes of sexual conduct and procreation for the entire nation. The court majority adopted an extreme individualist philosophy in these cases, seeming to assert that society acting through government had very little legitimate interest in such matters. Griswold v. Connecticut invalidated a law prohibiting the use of contraceptives on the ground that government must not enter the marital bedroom. That focus, spurious as it was, at least seemed to confine the right of privacy to areas of life that all Americans would agree remain private. But almost at once, the court majority began to alter the new right's rationale, and hence to expand its coverage in unpredictable ways. Massachusetts enacted a law regulating the distribution rather than the use of contraceptions. The law provided that married persons could obtain contraceptives to prevent pregnancy on prescription only, and single persons could not obtain contraceptives for the purpose of preventing pregnancy, but only to prevent the spread of disease. It was not apparent that the law made much sense, but that is not the same as being unconstitutional. In 1972, the Eisenstadt v. Baird, the Supreme Court invalidated the statute under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment and began the transformation of the right of privacy. If under Griswold, the distribution of contraceptives to married persons cannot be prohibited, a ban on distribution to unmarried persons would be equally impermissible. It is true that in Griswold, the right of privacy in question inhered in the marital relationship. Yet the marital couple is not an independent entity with a mind and heart of its own, but an association of two individuals, each with a separate intellectual and emotional makeup. If the right of privacy means anything, it is the right of the individual, married or single, to be free from unwarranted governmental intrusion into matters so fundamentally affecting a person as the decision whether to bear or beget a child. Griswold did not, of course, deal with the distribution of contraceptives, but with a prohibition of use. That case, moreover, rested upon a rhetorical appreciation of marriage and the marital bedroom. Now that rhetorical line was dropped because the Massachusetts statute treated married couples and single persons differently, and the court wanted to strike down the law as to unmarried people. Significantly, the argument of the court shifted from the sanctity of a basic institution, marriage, to the sanctity of individual desires. The unmarried individual has, as a matter of fact, the freedom to decide whether to bear or beget a child, of course, because he or she has the right to choose whether or not to copulate. But that did not seem enough to the court, perhaps because copulation could not be burdened either by marital status or by abstinence from its pleasures. There may or may not be something to be said for this as a matter of morality, but there is nothing to be said for it as constitutional law. The Constitution simply does not address the subject. Nor, after Eisenstadt, were we much further along in knowing what it is that the right of privacy does cover. In order to apply the precedent in the next litigant's claim to be free of a law on the grounds of privacy, one would have to know whether the challenged governmental regulation was unwarranted, which is in no way defined by the opinion, and whether the regulation concerned a matter so fundamentally affecting a person as the decision whether to bear or beget a child. The opinion gives no guidance for deciding the issue either. It was impossible to tell from Eisenstadt where the right of privacy might strike next. We soon learned. The subject of abortion had been fiercely debated in state legislatures for many years. It raised profound moral issues upon which people of goodwill can and do disagree, depending on whether they view a fetus as fully human and therefore not to be killed for anyone's convenience, or whether they think the fetus less than human so that the desires of a pregnant woman should be paramount. Whatever the proper resolution of the moral debate, a subject which there is no need to address here, few people imagined that the Constitution would have resolved it. In 1973, a majority of the Supreme Court did imagine just that in Roe v. Wade. In an opinion of just over 51 pages, Justice Blackmun, writing for a majority of 7 justices, employed the right of privacy to strike down the abortion laws of most states to set severe limitations upon the state's power to regulate the subject at all. From the beginning of the Republic until that day, January 22, 1973, the moral question of what abortions should be lawful had been left entirely to state legislatures. The discovery this late in our history that the question was not one for democratic decision, but one of constitutional law, was so implausible that it certainly deserved a 51-page explanation. Unfortunately, in the entire opinion, there is not one line of explanation, not one sentence that qualifies as legal argument. Nor has the court in the 16 years since ever provided the explanation lacking in 1973. It is unlikely that it ever will, because the right to abort, whatever one thinks of it, is not to be found in the Constitution. The Roe opinion began with a brief recitation of the statute challenged. The appealability of the orders below and the power of the court to decide the issue. And then turned to the history of abortion and the interests of the state in regulating the topic through its criminal code. Justice Blackmun canvassed ancient attitudes, including those of the Persian Empire, the Greeks, the Romans, and the Ephesians, Serranos, often described as the greatest of the ancient gynecologists. He placed the Hippocratic Oath, which forbids aiding an abortion, in historical context, suggesting that the oath was not at first highly regarded and that its later popularity was due in large measure to the rise of Christianity. The opinion then traced the English common and statutory law, as well as the American law, on the subject before devoting sections to the positions of the American Medical Association, the American Public Health Association, and the American Bar Association. None of this, it will be noted, is of obvious relevance to the Constitution. Nor was any of this material employed as history that might illuminate the meaning of any provision in the Constitution. The Roe opinion next discusses three reasons said to explain the enactment of laws limiting the right to abortion. A Victorian social concern to discourage illicit sexual conduct. Concern for the hazards abortion posed for women. And concern for prenatal life. Note that the very concept of sexual conduct that is illicit is dismissed with a pejorative Victorian. This accurately reflects the court majority's allegiance to untrammeled individualism and its position in our cultural wars. And the court did not decide that the statutes were invalid because obsolete. That, for example, state legislatures had been moved by concern for women's health that modern medicine had rendered irrelevant. A statute may be enacted for one reason, retained for another, and be nonetheless constitutional for that. Had that rationale for invalidity been advanced, moreover, states could have responded by reenacting their laws out of an express desire to protect the unborn. That was not what the court had in mind. The explanation of the true basis for the unconstitutionality of so many statutes begins with the sentence, "The Constitution does not explicitly mention any right of privacy." The existence of such a right is nonetheless defended by citing a series of cases to demonstrate that the court has recognized that a right of personal privacy or a guarantee of certain areas or zones of privacy does exist under the Constitution. Nobody has ever quarreled with the proposition that certain zones or aspects of privacy or freedom are protected by the Constitution. Justice Blackmun cites cases decided under the First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendments, but those differed entirely from the right he was creating in that they had specific textual support. He got closer to his solution when he moved to concepts previously employed by courts that lack support in the actual Constitution for what they wanted to do. The opinion cited the penumbras of the Bill of Rights, relied upon by Justice Douglas in Griswold v. Connecticut, Justice Goldberg's reliance upon the Ninth Amendment in the same case, and the concept of liberty in the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. Roe continued, These decisions make it clear that only personal rights that can be deemed fundamental or implicit in the concept of ordered liberty, Pelko v. Connecticut, are included in this guarantee of personal privacy. They also make it clear that the right has some extension to activities relating to marriage, Loving v. Virginia, procreation, Skinner v. Oklahoma, contraception, Eisenstadt v. Baird, family relationships, Prince v. Massachusetts, and child rearing and education, Pierce v. Society of Sisters, Meyer v. Nebraska. Skinner and Eisenstadt, as we have seen in this chapter and the one preceding, involve the court's creation of new rights without support in constitutional text or history. Pierce and Meyer, as we saw two chapters back, use the same methodology of creating rights, but at least reflected the First Amendment. Prince denied claims by the Jehovah's Witness to be free of the state's child labor laws on grounds of religious freedom and the equal protection laws. The case related to marriage, Loving, struck down an anti-miscegenation law on the grounds that the racial classification violated the equal protection clause and also the right of liberty under the due process clause, though the latter holding also seemed to depend upon the invidious racial classification. This is not a very impressive list of cases to support the claimed right of abortion. They do not bear upon the subject at all. Some of the cases were clearly instances of judicial rewriting of the Constitution. Others, at least, enforced values found in actual provisions of the Constitution, and still others denied the rights claimed. None of them remotely addressed the issue of abortion, and none of them even mentions a right of privacy. It is difficult, therefore, to understand why the Roe opinion supposes that these cases show the extension or reach of the right of privacy. They do nothing of the sort. Marshaling these decisions as if they were precedents merely emphasized the absence of support for the right. The invented right of privacy had not been applied in any Supreme Court case other than the ones involving contraception. Nonetheless, without any analysis, the Roe opinion then immediately decided the issue before the court by simple assertion. The right of privacy, whether it be founded in the 14th Amendment's concept of personal liberty and restrictions upon state action, as we feel it is, or as the district court determined in the 9th Amendment's reservation of rights to the people, is broad enough to encompass a woman's decision whether or not to terminate her pregnancy. That is it. That is the crux of the opinion. The court did not even feel obliged to settle the question of where the right of privacy or the subsidiary right to abort is to be attached to the Constitution's text. The opinion seems to regard that as a technicality that really does not matter. And indeed, it does not, since the right does not come out of the Constitution, but is forced into it. The opinion does not once say what principle defines the new right, so that we might know both why it covers a liberty to abort and what else might cover in the future. We are told only that wherever the right may be located and whatever it may cover, it is broad enough for present purposes. This is not legal reasoning, but fiat. The Roe opinion, then, legislated the rules the court considered appropriate for abortions by balancing the interests of the woman and those of the state. To do that, of course, the court had implicitly to decide which interests were legitimate and how much weight should be ascribed to each one. That, being unguided by the Constitution, was an exercise in moral and political philosophy, and would have been if some reasoning had been articulated. Or would have been. The upshot, in any event, was that in the first trimester of pregnancy, the abortion decision must be left to the woman and the medical judgment of her physician. After that, and up to the point where the fetus can live outside the womb, the point of viability, the state may regulate the abortion procedure, but only in ways related to the health of the mother. Subsequent to viability, the state, in promoting its interest in the potentiality of human life, may, if it chooses, regulate and even proscribe abortion, except where it is necessary to preserve the mother's life or health. Justice Rehnquist's dissent pointed out that it was very curious to decide the case under the rubric of privacy, since a transaction resulting in an operation by a physician is not private. Justice White's dissent, which Justice Rehnquist joined, summed up the trouble with Roe. "I find nothing in the language or history of the Constitution to support the court's judgment. The court simply fashions and announces a new constitutional right for pregnant mothers, and, with scarcely any reason or authority for its action, invests that right with sufficient substance to override most existing state abortion statutes. The upshot is that the people and the legislatures of the 50 states are constitutionally disentitled to weigh the relative importance of the continued existence and development of the fetus on the one hand against a spectrum of possible impacts on the mother on the other hand. As an exercise of raw judicial power, the court perhaps has authority to do what it does today. But in my view, its judgment is an improvident and extravagant exercise of the court of judicial review that the Constitution extends to this court." In the years since 1973, no one, however pro-abortion, has ever thought of an argument that even remotely begins to justify Roe v. Wade as a constitutional decision. Justice Blackmun frequently discusses the case in public, but the only justification he offers is not legal, but moral. "The case," he says, "is a milestone on women's march to equality. There is certainly room for argument about that. There is no room for argument about the conclusion that the decision was the assumption of illegitimate judicial power and an usurpation of the democratic authority of the American people." On the last day it sat in 1989, a bitterly divided court decided Webster v. Reproductive Health Services, a challenge to statutory restrictions Missouri had placed upon the abortion procedure. The crucial restriction was the law's requirement that before performing an abortion on a woman 20 or more weeks pregnant, the physician first determine whether the unborn child is viable. Five justices upheld that regulation, which seemed to narrow the scope of Roe. Three justices, Rehnquist, White, and Kennedy, employed the standard of review, which necessarily, though not explicitly, completely undermined Roe. While one justice, Scalia, stated that Roe should expressly be overruled. Justice O'Connor upheld the statute, but stated that it could be done without bringing Roe into question. Both sides in the abortion controversy at once announced that the court had made a momentous decision. It is true enough that states now appear to have some unknown degree of additional power to control the incidence of abortion, but Webster was neither the calamity that the pro-abortion groups bewailed, the court is waging war on women, nor the great victory that the anti-abortionists proclaimed. We will produce an avalanche of legislation. Though Webster altered little that was fundamental, it does signal the potential for such change. In Roe, the justices split 7-2 in favor of a right to abort. Now there are four justices who favor that right, four who think it does not exist, and one who does not reach the issue. Attempts to overturn Roe will continue as long as the court adheres to it, and just so long as the decision remains, the court will be perceived correctly as political, and will continue to be the target of demonstrations, marches, television advertisements, mass mailings, and the like. Roe, as the greatest example and symbol of the judicial usurpation of democratic prerogatives in this century, should be overturned. The court's integrity requires that. But even if the case is relegated to the dustbin of history where Dred Scott and Lochner lie, the right of privacy and the judicial techniques and attitudes it represents are likely to remain. A more fundamental rethinking of legitimate judicial power than the mere demise of Roe would signify is required. And I think that's where we're going to call it quits. So I'm nearly an hour here. But you get the idea. I highly recommend reading this book. Bork really should have been on the Supreme Court. Why he wasn't is fairly obvious now. But it's taken, 30 years since the rejection of Bork, and 50 years since the Roe decision itself, to turn this around, or to begin to turn this around. More importantly, for my libertarian friends, you claim to be people who respect the Constitution, and yet can't seem to find the will to fight in the legislatures for the freedoms that you think citizens deserve, whether that's the right to abort or whatever. if you think that the right to abort is a real thing, then I suggest you put together a campaign for a constitutional amendment, or you go state to state and fight for the laws that are needed to ensure it, because that's how the system works, or at least that's how the system is supposed to work. But the minute you start playing these games with Supreme Court judicial appointments, right, then you tell me you're not really libertarian. You're telling me you're actually authoritarian, because what you want is to impose a kind of libertine regime on the entire nation through the use of judicial force, right? That's what you're telling me. You're not really libertarian, you're libertine, and you're willing to use force to get it.